The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to day 15 of the Edinburgh International Book Festival with me, Claire Armistead. Today, we're going truly international with writers from Russia and Argentina and a physicist who ranges freely across the multiverse. He is James Kakalios, who held the festival spellbound with his book about the physics of superheroes. Novelist Patricio Pron talks about memory and secrets in an Argentinian family. But first, Mikhail Shishkin. He's been described as one of Russia's greatest writers. He's the only one, in fact, to win all three of his country's major prizes. His new novel, The Light and the Dark, takes the form of an exchange of letters between two lovers who appear to reach out to each other across time and space. She lives in a city in the present day, while he fights in some distant war. There will always be a war for tomorrow, writes Shishkin.
It's a love story, he and she, Adam and Eve, nothing new, yeah, all the same. No, it's a story about the most important things. Actually, I compare the writing with blood transfusion. If a writer, you're just sharing what is the most important, what is bringing life to you with your reader. And you are thinking not of entertaining your reader. You don't want to humiliate your reader just thinking that he needs only entertainment. No, my reader needs the answers to the same questions I'm asking to myself. What is love? What is death? Why we are here? What will be after death? What to do against the death? Yeah. And this is what is my book about.
Yeah. Nevertheless, your correspondents seem to exist in different times. She lives in a place where there are planes and aerodromes and things, and Vovka lives in a sort of battleground, which could be early 20th century, could be even earlier.
Look, we all live in the false, in the fake reality, yeah? Because every second we live is already dead. And there is another space, there is another level of reality, and the writer has the privilege, the opportunity to pick up what is really important from this so-called reality, from the death, and to take it with him into that space where everything is simultaneously, there is no death. And this is the space of the art, because only art can do this. Yeah, that is why we need the art. In my novel, yeah, it starts in the fake reality, in the so-called our reality. Then they go to the real reality. They meet in the place where there is actually no time and no death.
So they have to be together to meet. You have this line, time will be back in joint when we meet again. It's like it stitches time together. It's quite conceptual, isn't it?
Yeah, forget the word time. There is no time. There is just the death, and there is the existence, yeah, without death. That is what is actually any art about. I always envy the composers, because they can do it directly without the words. Because words are always misleading, the words are always lying, yeah? And the music can say directly, yeah? And if I'm listening, for example, to some eternal music of Rachmaninoff, yeah? In this moment, I'm becoming also a little bit eternal. That is the sense of the art.
Mm-hmm. You had another novel published at the same time, Maiden Hair, in the UK. It had interlocking narratives, and one of the stories is a story about a prisoner freeing himself from his prison through art. Can you tell us?
It is an old legend about a prisoner who was life sentenced. And on the wall of his cell, he is drawing with a spoon board. And one day, when the wards come to bring him some bread and water, the cell is empty and there is no board on the wall anymore, because he went away with this board. And for me as a writer, my novel is such kind of this board, yeah? Because here I am in this life, I am life sentenced. And this board helps me, yeah, to take everything what is important for me, people I love, my readers, and to go away from this cell, yeah, to that place where we will stay together for forever. But the words must be so correct, yeah, they must just make this boat real.
You talk about still writing in the Russian language, and obviously that's very important to you. But you've also been very, very critical of the Russian language, and you say it's been seized by a corrupt regime. In fact, you're very critical of the Russian state, aren't you? You refuse to represent Russia in a trade delegation to an American book fair because you said it had been, the country had been seized by a corrupt criminal regime.
Yeah, unfortunately, you see, all the hopes we had in the big early 90s, yeah, they all have gone. And when I am in Russia and I see all the steps of the government, yeah, it's disgusting. The politics of the government are just disgusting and humiliating me as a Russian citizen. I can't represent this state anymore. I want to represent with my books. You see, the new Russia, which will win anyway, because all the dictators can't rule 100 years. I think a couple of years will pass and the third attempt of Russian democracy will win. The first attempt of Russian democracy was in 1917 in February, but you see, because of the First World War, it was impossible. Yeah, and we got the Bolshevik Revolution. And the second attempt to bring the democracy to Russia was with Gorbachev at the beginning of the 90s, but we didn't have the so-called middle class. We had just 150 million of slaves. Yeah, it's impossible to just establish democracy with the slaves. And now after 20 years, we have a sort of middle class, we have no war, and I think the third attempt of Russian democracy will succeed.
Mikhail Shishkin, The Light in the Dark is published by Quercus. One of my highlights of this year's festival has been James Kakalios, who is a solid-state physicist, I think that's what you said, James, which I don't know what it means, but then I didn't know what a lot of what he was talking about meant. All I knew is that it related in quite extraordinary ways to comics, and one of the strands at this festival has been comic books. He's written books including The Physics of Superheroes, The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, and is also a consultant on movies like Watchmen and The Amazing Spider-Man. So James, tell me first of all what a solid-state physicist is.
Right. Well, solid-state physics is the branch of physics that deals with the properties of metals, insulators, semiconductors. So it's the part of physics that's actually useful. All of the devices we have in our iPods and our mobile phones and laptop computers, all are the basis of studies in solid-state physics. Why do the materials have the properties they do? Why do some conduct electricity better than others? How can we manipulate that in order to design circuits? So instead of having coils and capacitors, we can do it all on a chip. That all comes from solid-state physics.
What do superheroes have to do with it?
Well, superheroes are an inspiration, certainly. They provide useful fashion tips for scientists. But in addition...
So you have a neat line in Spider-Man ties. You've got one on at the moment.
Thank you. Yes, those kind of tips. And then there's, of course, the spandex when I'm out on patrol. But actually, what superheroes do, reading superhero comic books turns out to have been a good training to become a research scientist. Because many of the stories, at least back in the 60s, when I read them as a kid, would place an emphasis on knowing the laws of nature, knowing the rules of the game, and also creative problem solving. Their walls are closing in, the water level's rising, they've taken away your utility belt. How do you get out of this trap without cheating? So we don't have such dire situations in the laboratory, but we are frequently called upon for creative problem solving. And in that sense, the comic books have been good training ground.
So give us some examples of places where comic book writers got there first.
Got there first. Actually, it's kind of interesting. A 1961 Superman comic book kind of predicted a lot of aspects of string theory. He broke the time barrier and went back in time to, quote unquote, fix history. Save some Christians at the Colosseum, save Custer at Little Bighorn, stopped John Wilkes Booth just before he assassinated Abraham Lincoln. But then when he returned to 1961, he found that history books were unchanged. And as Superman says, certainly the history books have to be true. Ahem. But then when he retraced his steps through time, he discovered that actually all of the changes he made were in a parallel Earth, not the Earth that Superman lived in the comic book story. And so string theorists now take this idea, what's called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, somewhat seriously. Superman kind of certainly has anticipated a lot of modern efforts to develop a quantum theory of gravity. Another thing that comic books got there first involves Iron Man. So Iron Man has a suit of armor and jet boots that he can fly, repulsor rays in the palms of his gloves. But you never see Iron Man in the comic books or in the movies pressing a button or giving some voice command to activate, say, the jet boots. He just thinks about it and it takes off and it flies. And in the comic books, it was explained that Iron Man had a cybernetic helmet, so it picked up his thought waves and transmitted it to the suit. But you know, scientists are developing cybernetic helmets. Colleagues of mine at the University of Minnesota and at other institutions around the world are developing devices that can pick up the electromagnetic waves that are generated when you think. And then by decoding this and sending it to a computer, you can move a mouse around a screen just by thinking about it. Actually, they've been able to pilot a toy helicopter, a remote-controlled helicopter, and steer it by thinking about where they want it to go. And they are not trying to develop an Iron Man suit. They're trying to treat paralysis and develop next generation of prosthetic devices. But something that seems so fantastic, a cybernetic helmet, turns out to be coming through breakthroughs in the laboratory.
Do you think that there is something about people imagining something before they can actually test it scientifically?
Oh, absolutely. You have to have the ideas before you can solve the problems. A lot of the innovations and the transformations of our lifestyle today have actually been breakthroughs in engineering and material science, and not science and physics or chemistry per se. It's been said that science answers questions while engineering solves problems. But you can't solve the problem without the answer, but just having the answer alone frequently isn't enough. So the two have to work together, and they do work together, and have led to really transformations of the lifestyle that we enjoy today. But you have to, in order to answer the question, you have to start with what if. And it's that same what if that can either lead to an amazing fictional story or an equally amazing scientific breakthrough.
One example you gave was magnetism.
Yes. So you have, say, in the comic books, you have Magneto, the mutant master of magnetism. And he would frequently levitate himself, flying by means of magnetic repulsion. But that turns out to be not crazy. We are mostly made of water. Water is a material that's called diamagnetic. Diamagnetic materials are repelled by magnetic fields. And I don't know if you can make a magnetic field strong enough to levitate a person, but I do know you can make a field strong enough to levitate a frog. Because if you just go onto the web and you Google diamagnetic levitating frog, and really, who hasn't at some point, one of the first things you'll find is a video that was made by André Geim, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2010, and he placed a frog in a magnetic field about 200,000 times stronger than the Earth's field, and the frog is levitating. It's floating as if it were on the space station, but it's actually in the Netherlands, and it's because the magnetic field is repelling the water molecules in the frog's body. So there are things from the comic book that wind up turning out again to be true in real life.
What advice have you given Hollywood? I'm quite amused by the idea of you going along and saying, Spider-Man couldn't do this.
Well, you know what, Hollywood is kind of interesting. They would like to get the science right more and more, so much so that the National Academy of Sciences in America has set up a program, the Science and Entertainment Exchange, where they matchmake academics and Hollywood creators. Because Hollywood has realized that any moment that the audience is questioning the science that they see on the screen is a moment when they're not paying attention to the story. So they want to get the science just right enough that the audience won't rebel while they're watching the film. If they're home and getting a drink out of the refrigerator, that's okay. And so in order to help create a believable fake reality so that you will buy into it, they try to get everything else as accurate as possible. In a film that I did not consult for, the 2008 Iron Man film, nevertheless got a lot of it right. They showed Tony Stark, the superhero, as engineer, and the engineer as superhero. And in one scene in the movie, we see Tony Stark in his laboratory in his Malibu home building the next generation Iron Man suit, and he's doing some soldering, and he's using the same soldering iron that I have in my laboratory, and he's doing it right. I was probably the only person in the audience who got excited at Iron Man for the soldering. But the point is, he's doing it right, and it is so clear that he knows what he's doing that you're not thinking, there's Robert Downey Jr. playing a part. You're thinking, there's Tony Stark building the Iron Man suit. So there is a benefit for them trying to get the small touches right. Alex McDowell, the production designer for Watchmen, put it best. He said, we want to know what's around the corner of a long hallway, even if the audience doesn't go down that corridor. Because by building up all the small touches and making it as realistic as possible, it helps trick the audience into accepting the fantastic things that they're seeing on screen.
What was the last superpower that you experienced in your own life?
Well, I just the other day, I managed to pick up and hold an object that was going 600 miles an hour when I poured myself some ginger beer on the airplane. It was going 600 miles an hour, kilometers per hour. I'm going 600 kilometers per hour, no problem. If I'm standing still and it's going 600 kilometers per hour, then I have a problem.
The inspiring James Kakalias, wouldn't you love to be taught by him? It's back to fiction with our next interviewee, Patricio Pron, whose novel My Father's Ghost is Climbing in the Rain delves into Argentina's troubled past with a story of family secrets, memory, and history. Richard Lee asked him how he got started on such a very personal novel.
Well, the first kick for writing a book was discovering the map with documents my father had on his home when he was recovering from an illness. I had for the first time the sense that I've found what I needed in order to tell a story which was very difficult for me to tell.
Because the contents of that folder makes up the entire second section of the book.
Yes, it offered to me what I needed to convey this collective story into a single personal story, which is the story of a family during the dark ages of military dictatorship in Argentina in the 70s, which is obviously my personal story. I've tried to write this novel for a couple of years, maybe 2 or 3 years, but I always had a feeling that I wasn't doing it properly because I didn't find the right structure to tell the story, and most important of all, I didn't have the impression that I was doing the right thing by writing this short story. This story, because it was exposing myself too much and exposing my family, and trying to convey a collective story and the story of a nation into a single personal story, which was very difficult to do. But when I found that map with all the documentation my father has collected, I felt for the first time that I had what I needed to write this book.
What was it about it, the collection of newspaper cuttings and this map, as you say, that gave you something to hang on to?
Yeah, it was very surprising for me to discover the map because I don't used to speak with my father so much, and I didn't know at that time that my father was collecting information about the disappeared man on the countryside where he comes from. So when I found he had collected all this information about the disappeared man, the disappeared man was just a way to go deeper into history, to talk about the disappeared woman he knew very well from his early years. I saw for the first time that there were symmetries between our lives, because I was at that point, as many young people, I was trying to understand who my father was. My father was trying to find out what had happened with a man who was disappeared, that was disappeared exactly like his sister. So all the symmetries gave a structure for what I was trying to tell. And a book wrote itself very quickly from that point on.
You say that it's your own personal story, and indeed it's published as a novella.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to write it as a work of fiction?
Well, first of all, because I'm a writer of fictional stuff.
That's what you do?
Yeah. And being the writer of short story collections and novels, I'm acquainted with certain ways of telling fictional stories, which were useful for writing this book. We call it a novel out of convention, but in fact, what is told in the book is relates directly with my personal experience. I would say that the story told in the book reflects what I remember about the story. Another of my interests was trying to close the gap that the military dictatorship produced in Argentinian society in terms of a transmission of political and collective experience. What my generation knows about the precedent generations is very sparse, and the normal process on which a former generation tells the new ones how to fight against control and how to fight against authority was obviously interrupted by the dictatorship. So it was my purpose to help people, especially people from my generation, to rebuild the bridge, to cover the gap again and start thinking in collaboration with former generations about how to resist.
When your father read the book, he was moved to write to you with corrections, which you then went on to publish, or his side of the story, as it were. Did you feel free enough while you were writing the novel, knowing that this was coming?
I tried. It was difficult because as I was writing the book, I knew I would affect my family in ways I didn't know at that time. And when the book was finally written and I sent a copy to my parents, the first response was the silence. Didn't receive a single response for about a week, and the only thing I knew was came from my sister, who said that everybody was crying on the family, and she was obviously blaming me for bringing all the suffering to the family. But after that, my father wrote me a long letter that can be read also in English on my webpage, on which my father didn't want to correct nothing, but wanted me to know his side of the story. Most of the readers in Argentina took the book as a fiction, which is not. But at this point, and this makes me very proud, I've received comments, letters and emails from readers, especially Argentine readers, but also Spanish readers or Italian ones, telling me how the book had helped them to talk with their parents about the tragic events of their national history. That was very encouraging for me, and the best reason I can recall to write a book that exposes yourself so much as this one.
You say you're very proud of that, but nevertheless that the experience has been a very exposing one from you. What's the cost to a writer of writing a book like this?
Well, the personal cost is obviously very high, because if you are not an exhibitionist, and I'm not, you don't enjoy being talked about on the media.
And it feels like that. It feels like they're talking about you.
Yes, yes. You try to, keep cool and say this, they are not talking about me. They are talking about the book. And even being the response is mostly positive or highly positive, you can't help but feeling that they are talking about you and they are judging you, which is also very difficult to live with. But I wasn't aware of how heavy the burden was when I started writing the book, but the middle of it, I could foresee that. But I was also decided to go onwards, nevertheless, because it was my political task to write it. Most of the time, writers don't write what they want, but what they have to write. And in that case, I had to write this book, not for me, or not for my personal glory, but for opening up doors that were closed, to make possible certain discussions that weren't possible in the last 20 years in Argentine history.
You say it's a political project.
Yes, it is. I think of myself as a political author, which is not that strange at all, because in my opinion, literature is always political on its effects.
Patrizio Pron, My Father's Ghost is Climbing in the Rain is published by Faber. Join us tomorrow for our very final festival podcast, where we'll be in the company of two poet laureates and a Makar. Until then, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.